This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Yesterday, the chief UN weapons inspectors issued their report to the UN Security Council. Hans Blix, the chief inspector for biological and chemical weapons, said that Iraq appears not to have come to genuine acceptance of the disarmament which was demanded of it. Secretary of State Colin Powell said, "Time is running out." President Bush is expected to make the case for war in his State of the Union address tonight. The Carnegie Endowment for International Peace released a report yesterday titled Iraq, What Next? Assessing the Weapons Inspections. My guest, Joseph Cirincione, is one of the authors of the report. He directs the Carnegie's Nonproliferation Project. He worked for 9 years in the U.S. House of Representatives, serving on the staff of the Armed Services Committee and the Committee on Government Operations. Cirincione is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and the International Institute for Strategic Studies. I spoke with him this morning. So what do you think are the most important findings of the Weapons Inspector's report?
They really gave us a dual message. One part of it, which the president has picked up on, and many of the papers are headlining, is that Iraq is not complying with the inspections. They are not coming forward and giving us all the information, making their scientists available to us, and not embracing the idea that they truly are disarming. The other message is that, on the other hand, Iraq is not obstructing any of the inspections, nothing like what we experienced in the 90s, where the inspectors were able to go everywhere and see anything. And what they're asking for is more time. I think the most important message that the inspectors are delivering is that they think they can get the job done if they'd get two things. One, time, and two, more Iraqi cooperation.
Now, Hans Blix, in his report, has said that Iraq has refused to tell where its stores of anthrax and VX nerve gas are, or where its illegal missiles are. It's failed to account for 6,500 chemical bombs that could contain as much as 1,000 tons of chemical agent. It's refurbished a missile plant that had been destroyed by weapons inspectors in the past and has illegally imported chemicals that could be used for weapons. So this sounds like some pretty bad news, actually, doesn't it?
Sure. There's no question that Saddam has a lot to answer for. Most of us who have been tracking this for a long time assume that he has chemical and biological weapons, or at least agents for those weapons. And he hasn't explained what happened to large quantities of these chemicals and biological agents that he produced during the 1980s. It doesn't mean, and the inspectors point this out, it doesn't mean that he necessarily has them. It's just that we have these open questions, and until we have proof that they're gone, we have to assume the worst.
Now, Mohammed El-Baradei, the director of the International Atomic Energy Agency, who's heading up the nuclear inspections, says that there's no evidence that Saddam Hussein has resumed its nuclear program. What's the importance of that finding?
That was a very interesting comment. He's telling us that in the 60 days that he's been there, and remember these inspections are just getting started, they found no evidence of Iraqi production of nuclear weapons materials. And this is something that he knows about very well, because the IAEA team went in and dismantled all the Iraqi facilities starting in 1992 and concluding in 1998. They took out all the uranium that he had, and have been monitoring the situation from afar since then. He also offers a very tantalizing, what he hopes will be a compelling offer to Saddam. He says at the end of that sentence that if he gets full Iraqi cooperation, he thinks the IAEA could certify in a few months that Iraq does not have a nuclear weapons program.
What is the importance of that statement in determining whether it's time to go to war or not?
Well, the weapon that we're most worried about is the nuclear weapon. Chemical weapons are terrible. Biological weapons are deadly. These things can kill hundreds, thousands of people. But they don't change the strategic balance. Saddam had chemical and biological weapons in the 1980s. It didn't make any difference. He wasn't seen as a threat to the United States. It's the presence of a nuclear weapon that would change the strategic balance in the Middle East and be a weapon that could potentially destroy the United States city. It's hard to make a nuclear weapon. You do need a large-scale facility. It's difficult to hide such a facility. It's difficult to hide the hundreds of scientists you need working on these weapons. So if the inspectors are telling us that they believe that with more cooperation they can verify that Saddam does not have a nuclear weapon and is not working on a nuclear weapon, then that really is a powerful statement about how successful this operation has been in containing the threat, in freezing Saddam in place, and ensuring that he is not now working on a program and thus does not pose an immediate significant military threat to the United States.
My guest is Joseph Cirincione. He's director of the Nonproliferation Project of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and one of the co-authors of its new report, Iraq, What Next? So we have Hans Blix saying that Iraq seems to not have come to genuine acceptance of the disarmament which was demanded of it. And we also have the head of the nuclear inspection saying, but there's no evidence that that Iraq has resumed its nuclear program. So have the findings of Hans Blix and Mohammed al-Baradi changed any of your opinions about whether the United States should attack Iraq or whether the UN weapon inspectors should continue the process of inspections?
The inspectors gave us, I think, an honest, forthright appraisal of the situation. It's pluses and minuses, and it is a mixed message, and that's what makes this decision so difficult. There were some in the administration, the president's inner circle, which long ago decided that they wanted to go to war with Iraq, and it's not clear how much that has to do with Saddam's possession of chemical or biological weapons. But for the majority of the country and for the majority of the world, they've been concerned about Iraq because of its possession of these weapons. That's what turns Saddam from a regional bully into a global threat. And the president has been remarkably successful in convincing the United Nations to impose the most onerous inspection regime it ever has. This is an extremely coercive regime. There are no restrictions on the inspectors. They can go anywhere, anytime, inspect anything. And they've accomplished two very important goals. One, with the presence of tens of thousands of troops outside Iraq's borders, we have contained the danger. Saddam may be a monster, but right now he's a monster in a cage. Second, with hundreds of inspectors just beginning to travel around Iraq, they can assure, and al-Baradi points this out, that there's no ongoing large-scale production or development of chemical or biological or nuclear weapons or their missile systems. So we've frozen Saddam in place. The threat is contained, and this is what makes it so difficult now for the president to push his case, because he's still focusing on this compliance issue. He's not complying. He hasn't embraced it. Therefore, we have no choice. We have to go to war. But the rest of the Security Council and the majority of the American people don't see the threat. So they don't want to send hundreds of thousands of young Americans into battle if there isn't a real good reason to do it now.
There are people in the Bush administration who basically say inspections is a farce. I mean, they're never going to uncover everything. Saddam Hussein is never going to fully comply. So it's going to be this cat and mouse game that's going to drag on and on without ever achieving fully satisfying results. What do you think about that, and how does one go about evaluating the effectiveness of the inspections process?
Yeah, well, it's absolutely true that there's no regime that can find a group of scientists whipping up a batch of anthrax in a one-room laboratory. Even if we were to militarily occupy the country, you couldn't find that. You couldn't stop that. There are some things that are just very, very difficult. The question is, can you impose a regime that can stop militarily significant production and development? Can you stop them from developing a nuclear weapon, for example? And the answer to that is clearly yes, you can. This is the kind of thing that inspections can accomplish really without the kind of Iraqi compliance that we want him to give. We may never have answers to the questions of what happened to the 15,000 rockets that we know he built that could be filled with chemical weapons that we don't have records that he destroyed. Where are they? We may never find that out unless Iraq coughs up the documents. But we can put in place an ongoing monitoring and verification regime that can make sure that he's not engaged in large-scale production. The only threat that you really have to worry about in this point is that if he has some chemical or biological weapons, is he doing something with them to get them outside the country? Is there really a nexus that goes on with the Al-Qaeda terrorist network, for example? Is he sending these to a group of terrorists that use them to attack the United States? And most experts think that is just very unlikely. A man like Saddam would not give away his what he considers his crown jewels to a group that he has no control over. And the president has said that there's this connection between Saddam and Al-Qaeda, but there's been very little, if any, evidence to prove that there's been cooperation between this Islamic fundamentalist religious fanatic group and this secular Arab regime that Saddam has had for the past 20 years.
The Bush administration has hinted that it has more information about a link between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein that it will soon reveal.
The president's in a very difficult position because officials have been quoted repeatedly that we don't have hard evidence. Many of us expected that the administration or the United Kingdom or Israel or other countries would come forth after December 7th, when Iraq released its 12,000-page declaration. It was clearly an inadequate declaration, clearly just regurgitating past information. And we thought the administration would say, aha, here we have, he has not admitted this, we have proof of it, here are the facilities at A, B, and C. And we thought that because the intelligence assessments before that point were so definitive. The president had gone to the United Nations and said that Saddam was importing thousands of aluminum tubes that he would use to restart his nuclear program. These are tubes, aluminum tubes, he said, that were used for uranium enrichment. We declared that Saddam had begun, once again, the large-scale production of chemical and biological weapons. Very clear, very definitive. But they didn't come forth with the evidence. And many of us have begun to question how much evidence there really is. We make the assumption that most people make, that Saddam has these weapons, but the truth is we just don't know. And what the president is likely to be able to release next week is going to be a circumstantial case. Things that indicate that there may be weapons here. There was suspicious activity at this site. There was a scurrying around of activity at a particular facility right before the inspectors come. Suspicious, yes. Convincing, no. Particularly because the particular cases the president has cited, the aluminum tubes, for example, turn out to be wrong. That they were trying to import the aluminum tubes for rockets. These tubes are not suited for uranium enrichment, as the inspectors reported yesterday. That there is no large-scale production of chemical biological weapons going on, at least that we've been able to observe so far. So the president's got a very tough case to make. I expect him to make it with great skill and terrific soaring rhetoric. It's after that dies down, however, I honestly don't think that we're going to have a case that will convince most people that the threat is urgent enough to go to war now.
What would it take to convince you that we should attack Iraq?
If there was evidence that Saddam had, in fact, a nuclear program underway, it's that threat that's the most urgent. If there were evidence that Saddam had actually succeeded in getting or was in the process of trying to get highly enriched uranium or plutonium from Pakistan, from the stockpiles in the former Soviet Union, that would be a clear and present danger. That would justify the most urgent action, including the military invasion of Iraq.
Are you confident that if Iraq had enriched uranium or plutonium, that weapons inspectors could actually find it?
Small amounts, no. He could probably still hide that. A weapons design, no. He could probably still hide that. It would be the production of uranium, the production of plutonium that he couldn't hide. Very large observable activities, difficult for him to avoid detection of those.
So if he wasn't manufacturing it, but if he just imported small amounts, would that be sufficient for him to create a nuclear weapon?
It could be. But see, this is the uncertainty. There's a whole range of uncertainties that you have here. The question is do you have enough proof to justify going to war? And the point isn't, wouldn't we all be better off if Saddam was removed? Of course we would. He doesn't have any friends in the area. His own people have been suffering under his brutal dictatorship for years. The question is weighing the costs and benefits, the risks of a war. And this is one issue that we have just not had enough debate on. We are talking about the military invasion and long-term military occupation of a major Arab country. This is an extreme measure. This is something that we have never done. Now, Western countries have done it. Britain, France, Germany, Russia, with disastrous short-term and long-term results. The U.S. is now saying, now we're going to do that. What I fear the most is that in that invasion, even if a large percentage of the Iraqi population supports it, there's going to be a sizable group that is not. There's going to be inflamed passions around the Arab world. We are going to unleash a new wave of terrorism against the United States. And the U.S. homeland is simply not prepared for that kind of danger. So I don't want to undertake those risks. I don't want to have hundreds of thousands of U.S. troops occupying Iraq for a decade or more unless there's a darn good reason to go do it. And that's got to be more than just circumstantial evidence. It's got to be more than worst-case assessments. You got to have an urgent threat to justify that kind of extreme measure.
If Iraq does have small amounts of enriched uranium or of plutonium, how much of a concern is that? I mean, what might they do with that?
You only need about 50 kilograms of enriched uranium to make a bomb. This is the program that Saddam was embarked on. The design is well known. It's a simple device. You basically slam two chunks of highly enriched uranium together. You get a critical reaction. The bomb detonates. If Saddam has a bomb, it is a major worry, a major concern. Not because he's going to put it on a missile, but because he might put it on a truck. He might put it on a ship and bring it someplace. And this brings us into the sort of nightmare movie scenarios where on the eve of an invasion, Saddam says, I have sent a tanker to your port of Baltimore, or maybe it was Los Angeles or San Diego. If you invade, I will detonate that ship. That's the kind of danger you never want to have to confront. The problem is we just don't know, and we'll never know. And it's not just Iraq. There are other countries that might try to acquire that material. That's why you have to have a multi-pronged approach to this. It's not just concentrating on one guy. It's not just smashing the international terrorist networks. You have to go drain the nuclear swamp. You have to go dry up the sources of that material. He can't produce this by himself. Al-Qaeda can't produce enriched uranium or plutonium. They have to get it from somebody who's already done it. There's 40,000 tons of, enough for 40,000 weapons in Russia right now. Almost 1,000 tons of this stuff. You've got to secure and eliminate that material as quickly as possible. You have to do something about the Pakistani program and worry that whatever we do in Iraq not disrupt Pakistan and let some of their material go. Let some of their scientists or some of what we think is approximately 30 weapons go. You have to do all these things at once, and the single-minded focus on Iraq, I think, is distracting us from the many other tasks we have to do to keep America secure from any nuclear terrorist threat.
But, you know, if Saddam Hussein could say, if you invade us, we're sending that truck with the car bomb or the ship with the car bomb to Baltimore, can he make that kind of threat even if we don't threaten to invade, and might that be a reason for regime change? If Saddam Hussein is crazy enough and armed enough to threaten one of our ports, that's a pretty big threat.
Sure. Saddam could bluff. He's doing a little bit of bluffing already, talking about how he's arming the population and preparing for a siege of Baghdad. Who knows if the population will actually support him in an invasion. This man is a danger. He is a lying snake. There's no question about it. The world will be better off without him. The question is one of risks and benefits. What's the best way to get rid of this guy? Is it really mounting a large-scale invasion of an Arab country? Do we really want to once again get in a land war in Asia over this threat at this time?
Do you think that the U.S. show of strength and the mobilization of military forces has actually helped the inspection process by really backing up the inspection with a lot of muscle flexing and a real threat of the use of force?
Absolutely. The only way Saddam Hussein is ever going to disarm is if he is convinced that he has no other choice, that he disarms or dies. That's why it's extremely important to have those troops, tens of thousands of troops, on his border and to maintain that pressure while the inspection process is underway. This is an essential ingredient in getting the success of the inspections.
The UN weapons inspectors would like the United States to share some of its intelligence on Iraq's weapons programs. The Bush administration has been reluctant to do that, for fear that it will compromise sources, it will make it harder to get more intelligence, and also those are some of the targets that the U.S. would bomb if it does attack Iraq. What are some of your thoughts about how much intelligence the U.S. should share and at what point it starts compromising its own ability to have intelligence?
Well, I had a top-secret code word clearance for 9 years. I'm familiar with intelligence. I'm familiar with some of the concerns the administration is expressing, but a lot of those concerns come into play when you're talking about a particular memo being released that was circulated only to a few individuals, or a conversation that only a few individuals would know about. But it really shouldn't come into play when you're talking about evidence that production is going on at a facility, or that there are weapons stored at place X, Y, and Z. There could be multiple sources for that information, and you should be able to protect your human intelligence. I think the United States has got to share what it knows now that gives it the best indication that Saddam actually has these weapons. I suspect that we know a lot less than we're saying, that some of the reasons that you're hearing the administration express are in part excuses for not disclosing that our evidence is actually a lot more circumstantial than it is. I may be wrong, and I hope the administration comes up next week with a convincing case and is able to give that case to the inspectors even before they publicly release it, so that they can use this. This is our chance. If we think Saddam has got a program, has got a weapon, and that we think we have good evidence of where it is, why not give it to the inspectors? Let them go find it.
What do you think is needed for the next phase of inspections to proceed effectively?
The United States has to keep the international resolve high. It has to keep the unity. This is really an unprecedented inspection regime. We've never had this kind of support for an inspection regime. We've never had this kind of carte blanche for the inspectors. If the U.S. holds especially the permanent members of the Security Council firm on this, we can press this for a good 2 months more and have a pretty good idea after that on the prospects for success or failure of the inspections. I actually suspect that this may be part of the administration's game plan, because while the focus has been on the inspector's report and the January 27th deadline, the truth is that we don't actually have the military forces in place to launch an invasion. If the president would decide tomorrow to go, we couldn't go. The troops that were ordered deployed 3 weeks ago are still packing. The tanks, the armored personnel vehicles, the helicopters have not yet been shipped over. It takes 2 or 3 weeks by ship to get this equipment over to the Gulf. The 101st Airborne, which many people believe would be the spear point of an invasion force, has not yet been ordered deployed. So there are still what most figure is 5 to 6 weeks of deployment necessary before the president would actually be in a chance, in a position to go to war. He may be gaming this out. And I've just had conversations with people in Washington recently about this, saying, okay, I'll compromise. I'll give the inspections 4 more weeks, 5 more weeks. We'll give a little more time because he's got that time to give. There's nothing he can do now anyway. So we may see that kind of negotiating policy play out over the month of February.
If, in fact, the Bush administration needs more time before it's ready to go to war, so it just kind of gives the UN weapons inspection team another month to carry out inspections, unless the weapons inspectors find a smoking gun, do you expect that you would have the same questions at the end of February that you have now at the end of January?
Yes, I do. And I expect that many in the administration would have exactly the same position that they have now. There's a group in the administration that has the ear of the president, has apparently won the debate inside the administration, that wants to go to war. They see this as being about much more than simply weapons of mass destruction, and in fact much more than just revenge on Saddam Hussein or concern about oil supplies. For some, this is part of a plan to democratize the Middle East, to shake up the regimes that were put in place during the Cold War, supported by one side or the other, that are now what they think of as strangling the prospects for a Middle East peace solution. They want to go into Iraq, establish Iraq as a democratic beacon. In that process, they will encourage people in Syria, in Iran, and other countries to rise up and overthrow their regimes. That will in turn help bring about a democratic Palestinian Liberation Organization that will give Israel a true, reliable partner to negotiate with, and thus you can bring about peace in the Middle East. So in their view, the road to Jerusalem goes through Baghdad. And we have the ability to do this. It's almost our duty, our mission to do this. This is part of a grand view in the eyes of some in the administration that will unleash a democratic tsunami, they say, in the Middle East and bring about a fundamental reordering of not just the Middle East but global politics. That's a very seductive view, a very powerful view of what you think the U.S. can accomplish and the historic mission that you are now in a position to fulfill. That is in great part what is motivating the drive to go in to Iraq.
Let's get back to what you described as a very seductive scenario, which is that the U.S. accomplishes regime change in Iraq, paving the way for democracy in Iraq, the Gulf, and the Middle East. You said it was a very seductive scenario. Do you buy that scenario?
There is a group in the administration, including Deputy Secretary Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Perle, head of the Defense Policy Board, and John Bolton, Douglas Feith, others, who are really on the extreme edge of foreign policy theory. And I'm not sure that people appreciate just how radical a group this is. We really haven't ever seen anything like this. And they have a real messianic vision. They feel that their historic moment is here. They compare the current situation to 1949, when a small group of people in the National Security Council around Harry Truman basically created the world as we know it, created the institutions of NATO, the United Nations, the new national security strategy for the United States. Bretton Woods structured the Cold War world. They think that they are in a position to do the same for the post-Cold War world, that we have wasted 8 years in the Clinton administration. They were on the verge of doing this when they were in the Reagan administration. They were robbed of their opportunity by the loss in 1992. They're back. They don't want to miss this opportunity. They have a missionary zeal. The question is whether America is going to be dragged along with this missionary zeal. I think this vision is extremely dangerous, that they are seducing America into embarking on a long-term military occupation of a foreign land. We have never done anything like this. This is not liberating Kuwait. This is not sending a few Green Berets into Saigon. This is not taking out Noriega in Panama. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of young men and women being brought into battle. Maybe it'll go well. Maybe it'll be house-to-house fighting in Baghdad. Maybe half the country will welcome us. Maybe half the country will now make those troops the subject of terrorist sniping and bombing. The risks are so high at this point. I cannot see the logic behind going to war now. We have this man exactly where we want him. We have put him in an iron box. Tens of thousands of troops outside his borders, inspectors inside his borders. There's no reason why we can't sustain that for a good year. We have contained the danger. The president has achieved a remarkable and remarkably popular victory. He should claim credit for this and give it some time to work.
I want to read you an excerpt of a Washington Post editorial from this past Sunday's paper.
Yeah.
You've probably read this, but I'll read it out loud. The posturing of the French and Germans, combined with the waffling of Hans Blix, has made war more rather than less likely. Saddam Hussein can draw only one message from the current debate, that the Security Council no more has the will to force disarmament on him now than it did in the 1990s. Mr. Blix's report and the European reactions will encourage him to cooperate not more, but less. He might be contained for a while, but in the post 9/11 world, another failure by the world's powers to enforce Iraqi disarmament would be a disaster, even worse than war. It would touch off a rush by rogue states for nuclear weapons. And the editorial goes on to say that the Security Council should admit that Saddam Hussein is in material breach and come up with some deadlines to deal with it. Your reaction to that editorial?
This is part of what I think is the mass exaggeration of mass destruction. I think the Washington Post has taken an extremely unhelpful and jingoistic tone to its editorials. The world is resolved on to contain Iraq. There is unprecedented unity. What we're asking for is more time to let the inspection process work.
Let me ask you about a specific line in that editorial. You're a non-proliferation expert. This Washington Post editorial says that what's happening now in Iraq could touch off a rush by rogue states for nuclear weapons. So what kind of precedent do you think that we're setting either with war or with a prolonged inspections in process in terms of rogue states getting nuclear weapons?
The inspection process right now is showing that we will not tolerate this, that the world is united, that Saddam cannot have these weapons. An invasion might send exactly the opposite message. If you're Iran, what lesson do you learn from this? That you'd better abandon your nuclear ambitions or you better speed them up? The Indian chief of staff of the Indian Army said that the lesson of the Persian Gulf War in 1991 was that if you're going to go up against the United States, you better have a nuclear weapon. There are some countries that might draw the conclusion from this, one, that they may be on America's hit list next, and they better get a deterrent, or two, that American leadership is so irresponsible at this point that they can no longer rely on a close alliance with the United States to protect their interest, and perhaps they should re-examine their nuclear options. So war can accomplish exactly the opposite of what some people intend. Instead of a resolute message, disarm or die, it could send the message, get a nuke now or face us later.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Joseph Cirincione. He's director of the Nonproliferation Project of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and he's co-author of the endowment's recent report, its new report called Iraq, What Next? What countries have actually started programs for weapons of mass destruction and then abandoned those programs, and what lessons can we learn about what got them to abandon those programs?
This is one of the least understood issues involving weapons of mass destruction. Three out of the four countries that started nuclear weapons programs, for example, over the last four or five decades, have abandoned those programs, never completed them. In many ways, the question isn't why do so many countries have nuclear weapons? It's why aren't there more countries with nuclear weapons? And it's not an issue of technology. It's not that this technology is now spreading around the world and there's nothing we can do to stop it. I'm going to live in a terrifying new century with dozens of states with nuclear weapons, as some in the administration believe. Rather, the technology's been out there for a long time. It's that countries have made the political decision not to acquire these weapons. They've turned away from these when they have found other means of resolving the political or territorial disputes that engender the illusion that somehow acquiring a weapon of mass destruction might improve their security. For example, people don't remember this perhaps, but Brazil and Argentina and to a lesser extent Chile in South America all had explored nuclear weapons programs. Brazil and Argentina making a great deal of progress, Brazil going so far as to be preparing a test site for a nuclear weapon. When those countries turned from military juntas to civilian control, the civilians turned away from those programs. And Brazil and Argentina and Chile peacefully settled their territorial disputes, and they all ended their programs and joined the Non-Proliferation Treaty, as have almost every single country in the world, and declared that they will remain a non-nuclear state. When you look at who's got weapons of mass destruction, there are vast areas of the world, Africa, most of Africa, South America, Southeast Asia, Indonesia, Malaysia, etc., where there are no weapons of mass destruction, none, no chemical, no biological, no nuclear. And the states that we're concerned about, the 15 or so states that have something, tend to group around, an arc of crisis that goes through the Middle East, down to South Asia, and then up to the Korean Peninsula. And these are all countries that are involved in unresolved political or territorial disputes. And it helps us understand that one of the ways to stop proliferation is to resolve those underlying disputes. If you don't resolve the Kashmir issue in South Asia, for example, it's very likely that we will see the first use of a nuclear weapon since Hiroshima in a conflict between Pakistan and India. You've got to resolve these issues in order for the governments to feel some confidence that they can reject these programs, turn away from this path, follow the example of South Africa, who built and then dismantled six nuclear weapons, or Ukraine, Belarus, Kazakhstan, all of whom inherited thousands of nuclear weapons after the breakup of the Soviet Union and were convinced by officials in the Bush and then Clinton administration to peacefully dismantle them and join the Non-Proliferation Treaty as non-nuclear members. There's a lot of success story out there. We just got to pay attention to it and learn the lessons.
You say that the weapons inspections are so far inconclusive and therefore the inspectors need more time. Say they inspect for another year and the results are still inconclusive, then what?
I think it's very unlikely that after a year of inspections the results would be inconclusive. We will have a very good chance that we will know one way or the other whether he's got their programs. At that point, if we decide that he does not have programs, we go into phase two of the inspections, which people forget about. That is to set up a permanent monitoring and verification regime so that we will know if any major activity is underway. We will never leave Iraq unmonitored as long as Saddam is in power. That's the plan. This man may be allowed to roam around his country, but he's going to remain under house arrest for as long as he lives.
Joseph Cirincione, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me on your show, Terry.
Joseph Cirincione directs the Non-Proliferation Project of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He co-wrote the Carnegie's new report, Iraq, What Next?